I have to go upstairs and record something again, so
quiet
and do not
smash anything
and do not disturb.
Do not disturb.
Do not come into your room.
Hi, you're listening to Pandemic, a new podcast from RTE News and Current Affairs on the COVID-19 crisis. I'm Colm O'Mungoyne, and most days of the week I'll be talking to RTE's correspondents, reporters and others to bring you news, updates and analysis you can trust. We can guarantee you a high quality of information. The sound quality, on the other hand, might vary somewhat sometimes, as correspondents and I will be recording this, in many cases, on mobile devices from home, so please do bear with us. It's Wednesday, April 1st. 40,000 people have died globally, 30,000 of those in Europe. So far, 71 people have died in this state. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has called for richer countries to help poorer countries whose health services and resources leave them vulnerable to the virus.
It is essential that developed countries immediately assist those less developed to bolster their health systems and their response capacity to stop transmission. Otherwise, we face the nightmare of the disease spreading like wildfire in the global south, with millions of deaths, and the prospect of the disease re-emerging where it was previously suppressed. Let us remember that we are only as strong as the weakest health system in our interconnected world.
We'll have a closer look at those vulnerabilities with Juliet Gash from our foreign desk shortly. But first, our science correspondent, George Lee.
Okay, George, welcome to your first of the pandemic podcasts.
Thanks, Colin.
Let's have a look at the data first today, George, because for the first time we've got a breakdown of some of the key data regarding the virus. What stood out for you?
Well, I suppose, firstly, the number of deaths has now gone up quite a lot. If you look at the island as a whole, by this afternoon, it's 101 in terms of the number of deaths. That, to me, is the key figure, because on the headline rate, which here is over 3,235 cases of COVID-19 positively identified, which is a big number. But because of issues in around testing, you know, it's more indicative than anything, because no doubt there are many more people than that who are COVID positive. So I think what struck me is the number of deaths. What also struck me is the first time that they've given us a clear indication that 83% of those people who died were over the age of 70. Now, previously, we've been given median ages, like median age of 80 or 84 or 79. Those kind of things came on certain days. Now, median is, it means that half of the people were above that age and half the people were below. But I think you don't know kind of how low or whatever. So I find it more interesting to find that 83% were above the age of 70. That is interesting to me. And one of the other things which I found interesting is that of all of the deaths which have occurred in Ireland, that 83% of them, that's 59 people, died in hospital settings. I think myself, I expected that that might have been lower because of the number of deaths which have occurred in nursing homes. But it appears from those numbers yesterday that we got that it's about 17% of the deaths so far are in nursing homes. And I note that in the UK, they weren't counting nursing home deaths at all until about now. So they're beginning to include them, and they have an awful lot of deaths. They have over 2,352 deaths in the UK. So it is, I find some of those numbers interesting. And the other thing which intrigued me as well about the numbers yesterday is that obviously healthcare workers who are testing positive is a huge issue. It's a huge issue because it's so important to protect healthcare workers. We need them on the front line. And so to get them back to work as quickly as possible is important. But the issue really has arisen about whether or not they were contracting COVID-19 in work or outside of work. And yesterday, I found it interesting that we got numbers about that. There were 647 healthcare workers out of the 3,235 who were positive, which is about a quarter. But of that quarter, only a quarter of that quarter were contracting the disease in work, either from a patient or from a colleague or vice versa. So that's 1/16 of the total. Of the total number of positives were healthcare workers contracting the disease within the hospital environment. So that's kind of...
They're kind of looking at a few measures to try and cut down on the amount of healthcare workers who are contracting outside of the hospital setting and try and bring down the attrition rate on our healthcare services before the surge really begins.
Yes, and that's important because if you take those numbers, that says that a quarter, so three quarters of them are not contracting it in work. So where are they contracting the disease? And as a result of that, the National Public Health Emergency Team is looking at the issue about what can be done to reduce that rate outside of work. And where they're looking at issues such as where you might have nurses living two or three together in an apartment or in a house. And is there some way for the period that maybe they could encourage them totally voluntarily with assistance, maybe to live somewhere else. Maybe they provide them with some accommodation or something like that. They haven't got to the end of that, but they're certainly examining what they could do to help reduce that rate of transmission among healthcare workers, mainly outside of work. So that is, I found that kind of interesting too, out of yesterday's raft of data.
Of course, the highest profile healthcare worker or somebody in the health field who has become ill, albeit not through the coronavirus, is the chief medical officer, Tony Houlihan.
Yeah, well, Dr. Tony Houlihan has got nothing. His what happened, I think, was yesterday. I was watching the press briefing myself, and I noticed that after him answering a question from a journalist, in the course of that answer, he seemed to kind of see a little bit uneasy. And it wasn't the question at all that had him uneasy, because as soon as he was finished, he turned to a colleague and he said, "I'm not feeling well." And kind of as a result of that, people kind of wonder what's going on there. It's not COVID ID, but when the press conference was over, yeah, his colleague said to him, "Listen, to take no chances, because Tony is very, very important. He's leading this whole crusade against this COVID-19. They said, "Take no chances, go and get yourself checked out." So he went to James's Hospital last night in Dublin, and they did some tests on him, and he expects to be released tomorrow morning, and expects to be back to work possible after that himself. Now, I spoke to him today and he was in very good form on the phone. He didn't sound like a sick man at all. He's full of energy in terms of his voice and so on, and certainly keen to get the message out that he wasn't particularly ill and that he does not have any illness related to COVID-19.
Testing, George, is something that came up. We had apologies expressed by the HSE for the turnaround time for tests of people who've been tested for COVID-19 but who have been waiting up to 2 weeks and more to get their results back. In some cases, people have died in the meantime, having from when they were tested to when the test results were analysed.
Yes, well, testing has been an issue from the beginning, particularly to an extent because the authorities here have been so determined to test as many people as possible. And so they started off with a testing regime and then they loosened it and said, "Everybody or anybody who has any symptoms, we want to test you." And then there was a rake of people contacted their GP. In fact, on one occasion, there was 21,000 people in a day put on a list. I believe that there may have been up to 80,000 people waiting on tests. It all happened very quickly. And suddenly they realized there was a big issue. They couldn't get the test kits. Every country in the world is looking for the exact same thing. Every country in the world has the same story. If you turn on the BBC News at nighttime, you have the exact same stories about where we're getting the testing equipment from. So it became clear that they couldn't keep going with that regime, so they had to focus it. As well as that, they were getting a 6% success rate on the tests that they were doing, which wasn't considered to be very bad value in terms of the tests. So they were testing people who didn't ultimately need to be tested. So in the environment that was there, they said, "Hold on, we need to do two things. We need to get a better success rate from the tests that we've got, because we can't just waste them. They're very hard to get. And secondly, we need to focus it on the people who we think, if we do find that they have something in terms of a COVID positive determination, that maybe they would be in a risk category, so we can help them more." So they focused then on the people who would have had two symptoms, which would make it more likely that they would have a disease, and secondly, that they were in a risk category. And the result of that has been that the increase, a big increase in the success rate of the tests that have been done, from 6% to 15%. So 15% of all the tests in the last short while have turned out to be positive. But secondly, they made the point when they made that announcement that it was short term. Their objective is still to get back to the point where they're testing 15,000 people a day. They're not trying to do less testing. They're trying to do more. And they've rolled out 41 or 42 test centres around the country, hoping to get it up to 50. They're not shying away from this. The problem and the holdup is getting the testing equipment and what they call That is one, the test swabs and all of them. And the second holdup is in the labs, getting what they call a reagent, which is some kind of chemical which reacts with the virus, which enables you to extract it to test it. And part of that is there are two aspects of those chemicals. One is something that can be produced fairly easily by lots of pharmaceutical kind of activities. But the second is proprietorial, we were told last night. That means it's most likely got a patent on it, which means they can't just repeat it. So there are issues that they're trying to resolve in all of that. But there's no way they're shying away from testing. They're just trying to make sure they get better bang for the buck at the moment. And they said that what they were doing at the moment is short term.
What's the aim of the testing then, George? In other countries, say, obviously, Germany, which is a huge biopharma sector where there's widespread testing, the aim is to get to grips with where it is everywhere in the community. In Ireland, what is the aim?
The aim is to shine a light on where it is. And I think you're dead right to point to Germany. I'll give you an example. Germany has 74,000 positive cases of COVID-19, but they have 821 deaths, which is very, very small. You compare that to, let's say, Italy, 105,000, which is kind of an extra 30,000 cases, but they have 12,500 deaths. Or you take the UK, which is far less than Germany in terms of cases, 29,000, you know, less, much, much less than half. They've got 2,352 deaths versus 821 in Germany. So you say, why is that? The reason why it is because Germany has assumed that this is the answer. Germany is testing really, really broadly. And in doing that, they're getting much more positive cases where they're much younger people. And so they're not under the same pressure as those over the age of 70 who are dying. So they're going to get a lower death rate per test. But secondly, in shining your light on where this disease is, you get people to self-isolate. And in getting them to self-isolate, you get to reduce the spread of it. So there are two big successes that they've got from it. That's what the Irish government is really trying to do, or the Irish authorities are trying to do. They're trying to find as many people as possible. That's the function of the test, so that they can say to people, sorry, mind yourself, keep yourself isolated. Who are you near? Who are you with? Let's check those people out. Keep them isolated. Stop the spread. Stop the spread. That's all we can do at the moment to reduce the curve. And so that's the nature and that's the reason for the test. The test isn't to make anybody better. The test is to stop the spread because we don't have any immunity to this virus. This virus could go around for a very long time and this virus could kill an awful lot of people and overall our entire health system. So the whole issue is how do you slow it? That's what the test is about. That's the most important thing, to find those people. And so the Irish, the HSE and the National Public Health Emergency Team are not saying we're doing less testing. They're saying, and they are determined to do much more testing. They're only waiting for the equipment, and that's what they're trying to do. And they're trying to get people to move with them on that. And they're getting the best bang for their buck that they can have so far. And the other thing is what they have found in relation to people's activity, which is very important, is they have found that 2 weeks ago, 2.5 weeks ago, they were finding an average of 20 contacts, close contacts, for each person who was testing.
Is it from contact tracing? Positive?
Exactly. So they were finding when they went and spoke to those people who tested positive, they had typically 20 people who they had close contact with. And so then they had to trace all those 20 people and ask them to self-isolate. That reduced, about last week we were getting figures of it, had reduced to 5, which is huge, and now it's reduced to 3. So that's really important because that's reducing the transmission rate of the disease. So people are playing their part by doing what they're being asked to do and by restricting their movements, by kind of social distancing, as well as washing their hands, as well as cough etiquette, as well as all of those things. So all of our efforts are really being positively reflected in the numbers so far. But we have to keep it up because there's no near-term solution for where we're at the moment. And that's the unfortunate business of where we're of the COVID situation.
All right, George, thanks very much. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.
Okay, Colin. All the best.
Cheers.
Now, to look elsewhere in the world, I've been talking to Juliet Gash from our foreign desk.
So how are you?
Yeah, good, thank you. Good. Isolating and working from home. So got a little desk built for me, which is very nice.
Good.
Good. Nice workspace.
You're also doing the DIY thing then at home. Great.
Well, I'm watching it.
Right. We've been doing a global roundup every day. Normally, we've looked at places closer to home, but you've been having a look at the developing world, specifically Africa, India, and Syria. So let's just have a look at Africa first and how the different areas of the continent, vast and all as it is, are coping with the coronavirus pandemic, and some obviously in a better position to cope than others.
Absolutely. I mean, just if you're looking at Italy, it has one doctor for every 243 people. If you look at Zambia in Africa, it has one doctor for every 10,000 people. And also one of the NGOs referred to the fact that Mali has three ventilators per million people. You know, so you're just talking about the resources not being there. PPE is a huge problem here. It's a huge problem in America. It's a huge problem in Italy. You know, while some African countries have been dealing with other epidemics, such as, you know, the DRC, and so they would have good PPE, other countries in Africa have not been dealing with various epidemics. So the danger is then that if coronavirus does take hold, which people predicted it absolutely will, then resources switch from efforts to treat measles to treat tuberculosis. 4,000 people die of tuberculosis a day. So tuberculosis is still a huge problem. But if the focus then has to move to coronavirus, what happens to the people affected by TB, affected by measles, affected by polio, things like that? So that's a huge concern. But just a quick look at Nigeria. So it has it's Africa's most populous nation. At the moment, as of Tuesday, the end of March, it had 139 confirmed cases and two deaths from COVID-19. So very small when you're talking about 195 million people. However, they have imposed a 14-day lockdown on Lagos, the biggest city in sub-Saharan Africa, which has a population of 20 million people. It has 111 cases, which is a drop in the ocean when you're talking about so many people. But a lot of these people living in very overcrowded slums, already having difficulty accessing food. So the night before, the day before the lockdown, a lot of people trying to buy food, prices going up, difficulty in sourcing food. And then people concerned now that will they be able to get food during this lockdown, because it's not clear that shops will be open or that they're even allowed out to go buy food. So the government has said it will be assisting the population with aid packages. But when you're dealing with such vast numbers of people, there is great fear that it could take hold there quickly.
And what look like modest headline figures are limited enough in terms of the testing capacities of the different countries in the developing world as well. Now, South Africa, which is a much more developed country and a much stronger economy, what measures has South Africa been taking?
Yeah, well, again, they have, a small number of cases. I think they've had three confirmed coronavirus cases. The last I checked, the lockdown began at the end of March, 27th of March. And they're going to be the first country in Africa to conduct large-scale screening. President Cyril Ramaphosa said that around 10,000 field workers will be visiting homes in villages, towns and cities to screen residents. The importance of that is so you know the size of the problem you're dealing with and so you can isolate people. There was some interesting figures, research by Imperial College of London, that basically was saying that, you know, with no measures whatsoever to tackle coronavirus, 40 million people would die. You could save almost 38 million people by bringing in really stringent measures. If you brought in some suppression measures, as they described it, you know, you could really change things. If you only brought in mitigation measures like physical or social distancing, then 20 million people would die. So, the heavier the measures are, the more people you will save, essentially, particularly in countries, as we say, that have weak medical systems and big populations of people living in close contact with one another.
And speaking of which, India is one of those countries.
Absolutely. Again, 1.3 billion people living in India. It's only reported some 1,400 cases, of whom 35 have died. Now, those numbers are tiny when you compare them to China, which has a similar size population. But health officials in India are saying that it's weeks away from a huge surge that will completely overwhelm its public health system. It spends only about 1.3% of its GDP on public health, which is among the lowest in the world. So again, you've got people living in close quarters. Now, they have imposed a 3-week lockdown. That's due to end mid-April. But lots of people then have defied those orders because there's a huge amount of migrant workers in India. They are moving, leaving the cities or trying to leave the cities to go home to their families and because their jobs are gone. But the authorities are basically trying to prevent those people from going back from the cities to their often rural homelands, because then is coronavirus going to spread there? So that's a fear. And also doctors there telling news agency Reuters that they have massive problems with PPE, this personal protective equipment we've been hearing so much about. And some doctors, and they've been photographed with this, using raincoats and motorbike helmets while trying to fight the virus to protect themselves in some way. And it's not...
Just want to move to the Middle East now. We've heard a good deal about Iran, Juliet, but Syria is a country that's entering now the 10th year of war and considerable disruption to infrastructure and a massive humanitarian crisis already, both in terms of the refugee populations on the over the border and the internally displaced people within Syria. What's the picture there and what are the concerns?
Again, it has just 10 confirmed cases. It recorded its first death on Sunday last. Now it's had two deaths. Officials deny a cover-up, but they have imposed a lockdown and draconian measures, including a nighttime curfew to stem the pandemic. But the United Nations has said that Syria faces a high risk of a major outbreak because of its fragile health system. I mean, you look at Idlib, for example, in northern Syria. We know that since last December, 1 million people have moved to that area, mostly women and children. 80% of them are women and children. They're living in overcrowded conditions. Something like 85 hospitals in Idlib province have been destroyed in the previous year, which leaves three hospitals for a population of around 3 million people. So they just don't have the capacity whatsoever. And you've got all of these things combining to just make it a dreadful situation if indeed COVID-19 takes hold there. The UN Emergency Relief Coordinator, Mark Lowcock, said earlier this week that that these 10 cases were just the tip of the iceberg, because there's so many vulnerable communities. If it takes hold there, there's just massive fear. Several NGOs have mentioned that they're particularly afraid of Syria because of so many refugees. There's 7 million displaced people within Syria alone. As I mentioned, 1 million of those are in Idlib. And a lot of these people are living in unsanitary conditions because they've had to flee the war. They're living on top of one another. I mean, we're being told daily, you know, hourly, minute by minute,
wash your hands.
If you can't even wash your hands, what hope have you got to stop this? If you're living in a tent with several families, how can you isolate? You know, so it's terrifying to think what could happen if the virus were to take hold in somewhere again, like Médecins Sans Frontières were pointing out, the refugee camp of Moria in Lesbos in Greece. It's the biggest refugee enclosure in Europe. And again, they don't have proper sanitary conditions. And while NGOs like MSF are working hard to protect people, they haven't had the sort of surge of diseases, and they're terrified of what will happen if they do. And they're really calling for international solidarity. I think that's a message that's emerging this week, that so far it's been rich countries that are fighting fire here, but we can't forget that there are a lot of poorer countries, a lot of developing countries that don't have the wherewithal to do this. And it's not just about protecting our more challenged brethren. It's also pointing out quite cleverly, I think, that if we manage to, in the developed world, fight the virus and get rid of it or flatten this curve and, you know, stamp it down, if it's elsewhere in the world, it'll come back to us. So it's not just about charity for charity's sake, it's about protecting the world from a resurgence if we do manage to battle it in the developed world.
Another story you've been working on, Juliet, over the last while is the issue of how this disease arose in the first place, and particularly not so much a scapegoat as a scaly mammal in the form of the pangolin. What is a pangolin, or am I even pronouncing that right?
The pangolin, yes, the pangolin. So, yes, this poor little critter has been has been targeted as perhaps the origin of the novel coronavirus. They look like reptiles. They almost look like little dinosaurs because they're covered in scales, but they're actually mammals, the only ones covered in scales. Some people talk about it as being a scaly anteater because it kind of has that appearance, really, really long tongue. It also eats a lot of ants, but it is indeed a mammal. And it has the unfortunate title of being the most poached mammal on Earth. It's trafficked because of the fact that it has, it's seen in some countries, parts of Africa and Vietnam and China, as a delicacy. In Asia, it's also seen as a traditional medicine, a cure from things from erectile dysfunction to cancer, depending on which text you read. So it has, unfortunately, now been linked to coronavirus, which perhaps more bad PR.
Yeah, so why is that? How did the focus, how did it go from cure, as you say, for many ailments allegedly to being the cause of many ailments?
Indeed. So it's a bit of a jump. So basically, it's widely understood that this coronavirus outbreak started in Wuhan, and a lot of people were reporting 41 severe cases of pneumonia were announced in Wuhan, and many of those people had visited a particular wet market in the city. So that's a city that sells fish and meat and things like that. But it also has a notorious wildlife section where they sell some rather exotic creatures. At first as well, when they discovered that this pneumonia was caused by a coronavirus, they then looked at other coronaviruses such as SARS, which has a link to bats. Now, SARS was this severe acute respiratory syndrome, which also emerged in China. It eventually infected 8,000 people and killed around 700 people. So a much smaller outbreak than what we're dealing with now. But it was one of the first times we'd seen a coronavirus attack, I suppose, humans rather than animals, because bats have been living with coronaviruses for a very long time. They've adapted to deal with lots of viruses. So the bat was seen as the first culprit. But it was also believed by scientists that because the differences between humans and bats, even though apparently we're more similar to bats than we are to cats and dogs, we needed an intermediary animal in between bats and humans for that original SARS to transmit from us.
Right. So is that how we turn our attention to the pangolin? That the pangolin
exactly
is
was
the link
this
animal?
The missing link? Exactly. So pangolins also carry a coronavirus, which is almost identical to the current coronavirus, which is called SARS-CoV-2. However, researchers in China and Hong Kong said that the role of pangolins can't be confirmed, even though they have very, very similar strains of a coronavirus. So it's not entirely conclusive. It's also interesting to point out that when China did tests on this wet market in Wuhan, they found it on surfaces there, on lots of surfaces. But it's not clear that it was already there or if humans put it on the surfaces. And also there was no proof of pangolins ever being traded at this wet market in Wuhan, because the trade of them is illegal. So it's quite inconclusive, essentially, as to is the pangolin to blame. And if there's any little chink of light for this little critter, it's that a more comprehensive ban was brought in on the trade and consumption of wild animals. And we're now hearing that African traders are seeing a big decline in demand for pangolin meat since the pandemic. So maybe it will actually prove to be good news for the little reclusive animal.
All right. Okay. Thanks, Juliet. We'll chat to you soon on that and possibly other creatures.
Indeed.
And that's all for this episode of Pandemic. We're back tomorrow with more. In the meantime, do get in contact with suggestions or questions by email to colm.omongain@rte.ie. That's colm.omongain@rte.ie. Or on Twitter at @ColumOmongain. Do subscribe through your usual podcast platform to get this podcast regularly. Reviews are welcome. And of course, nice reviews even more welcome. So until tomorrow, take care. Slán.